If you don't have a relationship and you can't target a particular audience, try to engage them somehow, whether it's through absurdity or something else.
There's certainly lots of personal stories there. I think there are professional thoughts on, you know, where your code is kept and, you know, what political unrest can do to impact your ability to produce stuff. Well, A, getting you a Mac that was built this century, and then B, doing the reboots.
Why you gotta hate on my computer, man?
And Jeremiah's like, will you guys just shut up and get on with the episode?
I'm just going to jump right into this episode real quick. And I just want to say I turned 41 this week. And as a sign of how much my life has changed, I'm just trying to find a good pair of sweatpants that are good looking enough for, you know, my wife to still find me attractive at 41, but comfortable enough that, you know, I can haul the kids around at dinner time and do what I got to do at bedtime for the kids. And feel comfortable. So if anybody listening to this knows what a 41-year-old man should buy, show at resultsjunkies.com or find me on Twitter. I'll pay you a referral fee or something. But I'm serious. I need to find some good sweatpants.
Paul has crossed the Mendoza line. He's past 40 and into 41 and talking about what sweatpants are going to make his wife still find him attractive. I personally think the answer is none. But I wear sweatpants pretty frequently, and I just understand that as I approach 50 and not 40, that there's, you know, there's probably nothing I can do at this point that I can wear that's going to make my wife find me more attractive today.
Well, I it's just, you know, with a couple kids in tow and all that, I just want something comfortable. So I put something out on Twitter earlier this week.
Don't you have like 7 kids?
What's that?
Don't you have like 7 kids, not a couple?
Oh man, yeah, I'm trying to start a football team here. yeah, no, I put something out on Twitter about this, and the thread was amazing. So anyway, now I'm like overwhelmed. I'm kind of curious what other people think. So find me a pair of sweatpants. This might be a new website, by the way. Find Paul a pair of sweatpants.
Did you click on any of the links to see how disgustingly expensive the sweatpants that people are recommending?
Insane.
Are?
Insane. Yeah. Like, yep. I went over to like, somebody recommended Lululemon, checked that out, went all the way over to Uniqlo. There were a bunch of other ones in between.
Yep.
Kind of overwhelming.
Yeah. I will tell you, like, spoiler alert, I went through this, though I was certainly looking for something significantly less stylish than you. I just want it comfortable. And I remember like clicking on, you know, Champion and stuff I bought all my life. And, you know, like I went and looked at the pricing. I was like, ah, it's kind of expensive because there were some prices that were, you know, like $60, $70, $80. And then, you know, my wife, Michelle, rattled off a couple other brand names, some of the ones that you just mentioned. And I just jaw dropped when I was seeing like, not three digit numbers. It didn't start with a one for a pair of sweatpants.
Well, you know, the thing is like, there is something constructive in this, by the way, which is that I don't buy a lot of stuff. I don't know. Ever since the Airstream days, I just don't need a lot of stuff. So I don't buy a whole lot. But what's interesting is that when you do turn on that like consumer mentality and you're looking for something, the paradox of choice, you know, not discounting what you just said there about prices, by the way, I'm just saying like, it's interesting for me, like putting on that consumer hat and looking for something and noticing just how many choices there are in 2022. It is a nice sort of reminder to me of, you know, kind of like what our customers are dealing with too, you know, to us, we are the best, whatever, right? You know, but then to that mom or to that customer, it's like, how do I choose?
Well, and here's a question for you, because we've talked about this so ad nauseum on the show. Did you forget to untarget yourself in any of the random apps like Facebook or Instagram and stuff? And are you getting 7,000 sweatpants ads in one of those
apps
right now?
So I toggled this off and then on and then off. So just to be clear, for the ask not to track feature, I think that's what you're asking about, right?
Yep.
I originally turned it off just to see what would happen. Then I turned it on just to see what happened. And then actually pretty recently turned it back off. Okay. So like Q2, Q3 last year when I had it off, my ads were all over the place. Like just all over the place. I was getting targeted for XYZ. I'm like, what in the world? Okay. So then I turned it back on and it kind of went back to where I was, you know, pre, iOS 14.5, except it was just much more impressions. So, you know, I think people, like, if they could target somebody, they were driving tons of money at, like, just making me see the same ad and over and over. There's a point to this. But now, when I turned it back off, what I've noticed a lot of companies doing is, for people like me that they can't target right now, they're just basically blanketing. Their ads are basically the most absurd thing they have. So actually, I tweeted about this earlier this week, about a Nordstrom ad that I got served for pant boots. And
if I must have missed this tweet.
Yeah, you'll see it in my thread, on my Twitter feed last week. But the only logical conclusion here is that for audiences they cannot target, maybe one of the strategies is to go as absurd as possible just to get engagement with the ad. Which, if that's true, it worked. I looked at this, I'm like, why did I get targeted for this? I tweet about it, people start talking about Nordstrom. Like, and I guess that's the key thing here, by the way, is that that is maybe one of the interesting strategies that is emerging in this new world, is that, you know, if you don't have a relationship and you can't target a particular audience, you try to engage them somehow, whether it's through absurdity or something else. Interesting tactic. I'm curious if anybody else listening to the podcast has seen similar things or even other strategies that nobody's talking about.
Yeah. And I just looked at that picture and those are some of the most absurd things I've ever seen. So that's interesting. Now I'm going to ask my wife about them and she's going to not only tell me, yeah, I've heard of those. She's going to give me rhyme and verse on what they actually are and who to buy them from and all that stuff. And I'll feel even older and less relevant than I already do.
But call me out here. Doesn't the strategy kind of make sense? Like, if we're just kind of guessing from the outside here, right? But like, let's start from the let's just pick on Nordstrom because that's what the tweet was about. Like, let's start from the premise that whoever runs their ad account is smart. You know, like, this wasn't a mistake. And then let's also add to that premise and say that they've got to deploy this budget. You know, they've got to, you know, increase the top of their funnel somehow, despite the, you know, this new iOS world we're in. So if those things are true, then the fact that they're advertising these things, it seems conscious and obvious to me. So anyway, like, poke holes in that.
Work with me here for a second. When's the next time you're going to Peoria?
This coming week.
Okay, here's what I want you to do. Set a calendar reminder. Remember to do this. I want you, when you're in Peoria, are you staying overnight?
Mm-hmm, yep.
Yeah, okay. So like, when you get to your hotel in Peoria, log on to the hotel internet, and then I want you to tell me if you're served these same ads. Because I'm curious. Like, I think I'm on the same page with you, but here's the thing. Like, we also, like, you know, Paul and I both live in Northern Virginia. Like, this is Nordstrom's key demographic, skews white, skews rich, you know. So I'm just curious, which, you know, with Peoria being very different, do you get targeted different ads? Like, how are they determining the demos on this stuff from a tracking standpoint? And if you get the same ads from a hotel Wi-Fi connection, I'll be really interested.
Report back next week.
Yes. We want to dig into Russia and Ukraine, because so much of what's out there. But, you know, just a brief reminder for folks, as Paul mentioned when we were talking about really expensive sweatpants, you can email us show@resultsjunkies.com. You can find him on social media at Paul Singh. You can find me at Pizza in Motion. And I think, you know, interestingly enough, if you look around, you know, we keep an eye on other podcasts. I think, you know, if you look around, do you guys remember a few weeks ago we talked about Canna? The beverage replicator that David Freeberg is rolling out. And, you know, we see, as I look around, you know, we see this being talked about on many of the big podcasts in this space. So it seems like there's some momentum there. If you want to hear our thoughts on it, you can go back. I'll put a link in the show notes. You can hear our thoughts on Canna and how it's very different from a lot of other startups that are out there. Just, you know, it's still a startup in its own right, but a very different model. And to Paul's point, when we had that discussion, almost a retro of, you know, where things were back in the 80s when Paul was still in diapers. Subtle, right? So let's talk. You put this on the list. And it, gosh, I mean, you know, Russia and Ukraine's on so many people's minds right now. And when we set aside the heartache and the destruction that's going on there, there are lots of real world implications for startups with the Russian Ukraine conflict on so many levels. And I'm gonna drop it there for a second because you put this in the chat thread, and just, you know, let you riff on it.
Yeah, look, on a personal note, I think it's hard to focus on professional stuff when you personally, you know, when your brain is like looking at what's happening over there and watching. So it is hard, and I'm sure a lot of people are kind of going through that as well. But you know, with that in mind, I think one of the sort of related topics that I is worth talking about is thinking about what the risks might be to your business. And there's not enough time on today's show to kind of go through it all, but I think there's two high-level topics I just wanted to talk about, mostly because I'm going to be talking about this with my team here in a couple of days. We're getting together to start talking about Q2 and how we had to what we're going to adjust on our strategy, just to protect ourselves. Okay, so high level here, there's a lot of things we can't control from a business standpoint. You know, things like how long will this conflict last? What will it do to global markets? What might it do to supply chain? What are the follow-on or, you know, third order effects of this, you know, in terms of China and Taiwan or other things? All those are things that we cannot control. We cannot guess, you know, we don't know. I mean, we don't have any access to intel or anything like that, but there are things we can control. And I guess what I would say is for people listening to this, I think there are probably at a high level, three things you should be thinking about. If you are dependent on outside capital, venture capital, angel funding, whatever, I would probably pull that fundraise forward, like do it sooner and raise on the high end of what's possible. You know, nobody ever regretted having more money in the bank than necessary.
About this, absolutely.
You know, just in case like the markets go down. Because if on the other side of that, by the way, if the markets go really sour across, you know, the rest of the US or the EU or whatever, you'll see a slowdown in fundraising and investing and all that stuff. So thing number one is if you're thinking about raising money or you're dependent on outside capital, if your runway at the moment is less than 12 months, you should probably raise some money and build a war chest. Protect yourself just in case. The second thing you should be thinking about is supply chain. I think that the reality is you can't control what's going to happen. You don't know. I mean, basically, if you're selling physical goods and any or majority of those goods are coming from the Far East or anything like that, you should do one of two things. You either start looking for alternative vendors here in the U.S. or even down in South America and just at least start pricing it out. The other thing you should start to think about doing is diversifying your revenue to something else. Like, I'm not saying you should pivot your company, but I think you should be thinking about where your revenues are coming from. And if there's other things, if you can increase your customers' LTV with you through higher margin, ideally online delivered goods, think of like membership clubs, that are, you know, stuff like that, you should explore that. And I think the third thing you should be really thinking about is your company culture. I think that there's a lot of stuff happening simultaneously here in terms of like mask mandates going away, increased discussion about what the future of the return to office is going to look like. And if you haven't already, you should start taking an active look at that, because even if you're not thinking about it, I guarantee you your staff are. And I'm not going to tell you which way to go, but I think, you know, for people running businesses, you need to kind of like, don't get caught on the back foot there. You know, if you haven't started talking about what your plan is with your team, I guarantee you they're already thinking about it. And they've probably even like at a happy hour said, well, if they do this, I'm leaving. So whatever that is, this is going back to the office or this is staying remote, I'll leave it up to you. But those are the three things. So raise money, or at least, you know, make sure that your bank account's looking good for the business. Second thing is make sure that you're doing everything you can to increase LTV and net margins. I think that you do that through diversification, but I'll leave it up to you. And the third thing is think about your team culture and what you want it to be. You know, the goal, you can't ever please everybody, but you at least need to like take a proactive stance on what you want it to be.
Well, and you mean you there's a lot to digest there. I think, you know, when I think about Russia and Ukraine and how big the conflict could get, you know, first off, I'd say, you know, from a personal standpoint, I echo your thoughts. I go back to, I was a lot younger when, you know, when we went into Kuwait and into Iraq under, you know, the first Bush president. And yeah, I mean, war was this, you know, very interesting thing that sort of permeated our life. I wasn't in startups or any of that stuff at that point. You know, this, you know, I have some friends, you know, who are developers in Ukraine. And I know that there are lots of startups that use Ukrainian development shops. So, you know, I mean, there's certainly lots of personal stories there. I think there are, you know, professional thoughts on, you know, where your code is kept and, you know, what political unrest can do to mm-hmm. impact your ability to produce stuff. And, you know, to your comment about South America, I think, you know, Northern Mexico, there's some areas where there's a lot more production happening. We have some startups that are building durable goods in Mexico right now in the northern provinces. And, you know, I mean, when you talk about, you know, it was already difficult to get stuff from Asia and the ports are overflowing in the U.S., you know, as we close shipping lanes and we close airspace to Russia, a lot of cargo routes got dropped in the past week or so for airfare, for first and foremost. So there's now even more pressure on shipping lanes because there's so many thousands of pounds of cargo that can't move via these incredibly popular air cargo routes that have to get there. So I think for companies that are producing any sort of durable goods and for, you know, even stuff that's consumable, I think we're going to see significant delays based on this, especially if it keeps, you know, going past the next couple of weeks. And it's really scary to say this. Like before this, you know, folks have talked about how like we didn't see a quick ending to to the problems that we're having with supply chains in the U.S. and that it was easily going to go through the second quarter and start to, you know, get into the third quarter before things might smooth themselves out. You know, as we see this pressure, the longer this goes, it's scary to say that in March we're talking about this potentially impacting shopping for the holiday season. You know, like what it's going to cost to get goods into containers and who's going to miss the deadlines again. But I mean, we really are up against those sorts of challenges now, where because that system is so strained and so broken that there are likely going to be things that are stuck on ships for Christmas again.
Yes. I mean, I'm just going to echo everything you just said there. One other thing or related thing to kind of keep an eye on is that, as I understand it, for a lot of the goods that are coming in from the Far East, you know, they obviously primarily come into the Western ports of the U.S. And generally speaking, the unions that, or I guess the union, the main one that, you know, all the longshoremen work with or for, or whatever the right lingo is there, I think that contract's up for renewal this summer. So
correct, yeah.
You better believe that there's going to be at least threats of slowdown. So, you know what this really means, though? Like, obviously, it's hard to think about these topics because we're all sort of guessing, right? I think the main thing for everybody to take away from this is think about whether or not this affects you or could affect you. And if the answer is it won't because you sell software as a service, then fast forward 5 minutes here and move on to the next topic. If, however, you sell anything that might require a physical product or somehow if you sell anything that could be affected by these sort of geopolitical global issues, you need to at least take a longer view on it. As an example, by the way, you know, at Bump, we used to, you know, our days on hand used to be like under 40 days or something like that,
right?
You know, and we were like going towards like that magical, you know, negative cash conversion cycle. It was amazing.
Just in time ordering.
Exactly. Right. But now, we got to carry, you know, 4 or 5 months of inventory just to insulate ourselves. Like, again, and I'm not saying you should do this, by the way, you know, everybody should do this. I'm saying that you should at least make a conscious decision. Like a lack of a decision is also a decision. So just agree to that. But you know, in our case, we were like, well, we can't control the boats. We can't control X. We can't control Y. So let's just go ahead and get comfortable with extending out our own days on hand to 3, 4, and in some vendor cases, 5 months, just to make sure we're insulated.
And you might not want to talk about this, and so we might have to cut this part, but I'm curious, for folks that are listening that are in similar boats, are you guys using your cash flow to do this? Are you negotiating terms with vendors and understanding that you're going to pay a bit of a higher price to wait to pay for stuff? I mean, obviously, that's a big shift in the amount of inventory that you're carrying.
No, I'll talk about it. We don't have any debt. We have no debt other than like a revolving credit card that gets paid off every 30 days. So there's no debt. There's no outside funding or anything like that. We're financing it ourselves. But what we have done is slowly but methodically and consciously renegotiated terms with everybody. So go back 2.5, 3 years. You know, I have this written down in a spreadsheet somewhere, but I bet you the average, you know, terms we had were like net 30, maybe even in some cases net 15, because we were a lot smaller back then. Today, sure. I don't think we have any vendor under net 60. And in fact, we're trying to push it even higher while we help them get financing. So a lot of our vendors don't know or don't know what to do. And we're like, well, let's help you. We'll help you get that. Now, that's a very early part of our strategy there. I'll report back in like a month and let you know how it's going. But yeah, we have not taken any outside funding there. Maybe the lesson there, by the way, for everybody here is if you have not at least broached the topic with your supplier, you should. And despite how nervous you might feel, you got to realize they're having this conversation with everybody. They're just as afraid of you moving to another vendor as you are of them not giving you better terms. It's a healthy tension, actually.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, I think terms, you know, in your space and in a lot of these sort of like DTC spaces, you know, haven't been a key item of negotiation for a while. But I can remember back in the like early 90s, when I was first getting into the workforce, that negotiating of terms was a huge piece of the pie. And boy, I mean, it comes at a very interesting time, you know, because the disruption that we're seeing with Russia and Ukraine is also really messing with the markets. You know, Fed interest rates, all that stuff. Like, I don't want to take us down that ball of wax. But I mean, there's so many different pieces in play here here's what I would say, just based on my experience with this sort of thing right now, is for companies that are listening that are in the same situations that Paul are in, this is not a time to try and gild the lily or time the bottom or things like that. If you find something that you believe is palatable that helps you get to the next phase, you should grab it while it's available, because prices are changing daily on so many different things right now.
And I hope I don't think my co-founders would mind me saying this, so I'll just throw this out there. You know, we have a morning stand-up for the leadership team, and it's usually 5 minutes, you know, just a quick check-in since we're all remote. How's everything going? What do we got? What's stuck? You know, yesterday's meeting actually went very long. So a typical stand-up is like a 5-minute weekday morning thing. Yesterday's was like 35, 40 minutes. And it's related to this topic because, you know, I think, let me just cut to the chase. My co-founder Lee, I'm pretty sure it was Lee. It was either Lee or Christine. But one of them said, like, you know, hey, you know, it's probably worth teaching, you know, finance 101 to our management team. And Christine and Lee, if you're listening to this, and if I misquoted that, you can kill me later. But here's the point. I think that to what you just said there, Ed, I think what I would add is I would say that, like, one of the skills that is not talked about within the entrepreneurial community is just basic financial knowledge. So, you know, there's all this content out there about what does a term sheet look like? What, you know, debt versus equity? You know, there's all this content out there that you and I have seen and talked about. But very few founders talk about some of the jargon that you and I have just used. Cash conversion cycles, LTV, CAC, balance sheets, you know, debt finance, like all these things. And it's not actually rocket science. Like, I'm not going to say it's the easiest thing in the world, but it's also not rocket science here. And I think now more than ever for founders, you know, that have at least a little bit of revenue, you should probably get a book. I don't know enough of these books to like tell you what to buy yet. Maybe somebody here can, somebody listening can kind of tweet at us and I'll kind of retweet it out to everybody. But yeah, I mean, I guess let me be more blunt. If you're sitting here in the early part of 2022 and let's say you have less than 100K of annual revenue, just focus on brute force. The biggest risk to your company is probably still failure. So just brute force it. But if you're sitting somewhere between, let's say, 100K and 2 million bucks a year in revenue right now, I would get a book or however you learn, but learn the basics of cash management, balance sheets, P&L statements. You don't need to become an accountant or a CPA, but you need to know enough about it so that you can kind of at least have a bit of foresight on what's coming down the pipe for you. Because again, it may be nothing. You may look at it and say, nope, my business is insulated. My net margins are good enough. My cash flow looks great for the next four months. But I guess on the other side, what's also possible is you might not realize that you're actually upside down on your unit economics. Like it may look good in terms of you're looking at your Stripe account and you're like, wow, I made this much money today, right? But if you're not also bouncing that up against your P&L and then maybe projecting out 3 or 4 months, you probably should be. You know, for all that talk that the startup world has about grow at all costs, what they don't sometimes mention is that losses compound faster than gains. if you're upside down on unit economics, like losses will really compound faster than gains, and you got to keep an eye on it. So
yeah, and I think there's two threads to tie together from, you know, the early part of the conversation and the late, which is, you know, raising money and making sure you've got enough cash in the bank, and then understanding all these potential cash flow decisions. Because if you don't have enough cash, well, certainly a lot of these choices are off the table for you. And I think it's important to really understand and to think very differently about cash flow right now, because you're like, things are just like a great example for us in our business. A lot of the vendors that we buy durable goods from, sinks, you know, grills, stuff like that, they've just stopped providing freight quotes for us. And in many cases, they're just billing us for freight after the fact, because the rates are changing from the day the unit is ready to ship until the day it's actually picked up, which could literally be the next day. And so from a market standpoint, they're having to pivot and change the way that they do business. And we have to ask a lot more questions about those sorts of things. And so in order to be nimble on that stuff as a, as a DTC provider, especially when you're dealing with these, timing the cadence of how much product you're going to keep on hand and all that sort of stuff. Really understanding what your cash flow looks like, to Paul's point, like losses mount quickly. You've got to understand your cash flow so you don't end up in a pain point. And you've really got to understand how quickly the market is shifting, and what you can do to change that and de-risk pieces of your platform. Paul, we're only a few days away from this episode launching, and I feel like by the time the episode launches, some of these strategies may have evolved another layer or two, just given how much stuff is in flux. But I'll be curious to see when we sit down a week from now to record, obviously where we are on the war front, but also too, like, are there extra wrinkles in terms of how things are, what the ripple effects are on all of this stuff? Because obviously it's not just shipping. We've got development issues. We're going to have energy issues. The list of things is pretty significant. I know we've got a little bit of time left before we got to run out of here. And you and I were talking about this backstage, and I think it's, for folks who listen every week, you'll remember, 3 or 4 episodes ago, we talked a little bit about me noticing that Sean from My First Million had gone to single opt-in for his mailing list. And, from the looks of what you've been filling around with, it seems like that you might have taken that plunge as well. And I know Google reworked some stuff in terms of how it rates pop-ups and sign-up lists and like how much of the page it takes up and all that stuff. So I'm curious for you to just sort of like expound on what you've seen so far with the changes that you made.
Yeah. A couple episodes ago, we talked about, single opt-in. And I think what drove this started this conversation was looking at Sean Puri's Milk Road and how he talked about growing from 0 to 16,000 subscribers very quickly and stuff like that. And I think you said, hey, it was interesting you signed up and there was no opt-in, and I shared. Anyway, we can link to that episode. Here's the point. That the next day after that recording, I was like, well, let me just try this out. You know, this idea of like, let's try a much cleaner landing page, sign-up page, like you know, he and a few others have done. And then let's also move to a single opt-in for my newsletter and see what happens. Now, that's been running for about 3 weeks at the time of this recording. And I'm averaging about a 22.5% conversion rate per day for the last 3 weeks. For me, that's about 75 new email signups a day. And just to be very clear, that conversion rate, it is obviously single opt-in. So you could argue it is higher than average because, you know, typically your conversion rate goes down with a double opt-in because they don't click that confirmation link. But here's the interesting thing. Like I'm not lowering the bar. In fact, I'm basically segmenting them. So I'm using ConvertKit and getting them to sign up. And then I'm just putting them right into my email flow or my drip sequence. But what I changed about the drip sequence is that instead of putting all the content in the email, I put a little teaser text in the email, and they can kind of click through for the full post on the blog or wherever it is. And then I use that on the behind the scenes with ConvertKit segmentation to then mark them as active, right? So now obviously there's a chance that they'll just read it but not click, and then they won't become active. But what I've done is I give it like a 2 week window kind of thing where there's actually in my drip sequence, like they're getting 4 emails over the course of 2 weeks in addition to my Friday newsletters. So anyway, that was a little rambly. The point is though, is that that was an interesting experiment. And I think it's a reminder to everybody that they should think about email collection, and maybe just a teaser for next week or whenever we want to touch about it. All of these broader topics or all of these topics have got me thinking more broadly about our funnel. And I think this is relevant to anybody listening to this, but personally and professionally, like what is our funnel? And I think what it looks like high level here, and this is a teaser for whenever we want to talk about it, is I think that social media and events online or offline are sort of the top of the funnel for everybody. Now you could say also writing books or blogs, just anything you do public, that's the top of your funnel. You need to go as wide as you can. I think email is the middle of the funnel. That's where, you know, you're getting a more intimate relationship with your audience, and you're putting something in their inbox. And hopefully you've got enough of a relationship where they actually open the email. And then at the bottom of the funnel, you got podcasts like this, where, you know, you've got people listening to you for an hour at a time. So anyway, I'll just pause there because I think it might be an interesting conversation later on. And if people want to hear more about it, maybe you just drop us a line and it'll force us to put this to the top of the list.
Yeah. And I hope that you'll be comfortable sharing, well, either share with me offline, but if we can share on the show, as you get a little deeper into the whole single opt-in test, I'll be curious to see if your drop-off rate increases as well. If it stays the same, or if, you know, folks who are single opt-in who maybe don't have to work a little harder to get on are then more likely to drop off more quickly. So I'll be curious to see what your drop-off rate is, call it in, you know, a few weeks, after you've had a few weeks to test it and just see how things look.
Sounds good. I'm in.
Cool. Well, we got lots of stuff to talk about next week, including something right up my alley. We talk about Bitcoin rebates for buying hamburgers. I know that you want to have a good conversation about how many rounds someone should actually consider raising. So we got some good stuff still sitting on the cutting board for future weeks. But I think we chewed on some good stuff this week, man.
Been a good one. You traveling next week? I'm flying out to Peoria for a couple days, although there's a snowstorm right before I get there, so that'll be fun.
Oh, yuck.
But how about you?
Yeah, I'm likely haven't booked anything yet. I actually had a Spirit flight booked this week because it was the only way to get home from Vegas at a reasonable time, from Vegas to Chicago.
Wow, who did you wrong? Who did you wrong to have
didn't
to
actually end up flying it because things changed again because of COVID. But you know what's scary? The upcharge for the big front seat was $160. I was like, wow, like Spirit is not ultra low cost anything anywhere. So, all right, well, safe travels to Peoria. Remember to check your ads to see if you get sweater or pant boots targeted from your hotel.
I shall. I shall indeed. I'll let you know. I'll report back next week.
All right, man.
All right, buddy. Have a great day.